Well, welcome to Lectionary Lunch at Concordia Seminary on December the 2nd in Advent. We're in the first week of Advent, but of course this is the reading for Advent 3, and the Gospel lesson is Luke chapter 7. By the way, let me offer a public mea culpa, which I think is Latin for I screwed up. Because I scheduled things at the last minute, and we will not, I think it's true that we will not have an Old Testament lectionary lunch this week to be posted for Advent 3. It's the reading from Zephaniah 3. And the reason why is because I procrastinated, so we'll repent in the week of Advent. But we will do the Gospel, which is Luke 7, and it's pointed as verses 18 to 28, and then optional 29 to 35. But I think we'll just go through verse 28. And to kind of introduce the lesson, I would maybe say this, that this paragraph, which has to do with the question of John the Baptizer, that he sends to Jesus, and then Christ's subsequent teaching about John's significance, I would call it maybe the most Lutheran paragraph in the Synoptic Gospels, if I could say it that way, because it's all about things not being what they seem to be, and to use the Pauline phrase, about walking by faith and not by sight. Obviously, not just Lutherans believe this, but that's near and dear to our heart. So I think in its proclamation potential, there's, of course, a lot of ways that a person could go in a sermon to the congregation of God's people. But certainly one way to go would be to acknowledge the difficulty of life, at times the seeming contradiction or paradox of Christian existence, and yet to affirm that because of the deeds of Christ, he is the coming one. We are and will be blessed in him, and our identity as those who have been subsumed and confiscated for the reign of God makes us blessed more than even John himself, who's the greatest born of women. So it's an opportunity to be very honest about life and its difficulties and about the not-yetness of things, and yet to also affirm the answer that, yes, Jesus is the coming one. So, in context, there's quite a strong contrast. We have, at the beginning of chapter 7, we have the account of the centurion in Capernaum and how he believes Jesus' word, and his servant is healed from a distance because he understands how authority works. And that's followed immediately by the healing of the widow's son in the town of Nain. And I had to look it up, by the way. I forgot where Nain was. It's south of Nazareth, apparently, in southern Galilee. And so we have sort of two clear evidences that, okay, Jesus really is the one. And then verse 17, the healing of the widow's son, or the raising of the widow's son, ends with, "And this word went out in the whole of Judea about him and in all the surrounding region." And then presumably this is the word that John hears, but of course John is in prison. And so his experience is contradicting the report that he's hearing about Jesus. And so that's where the text picks up at verse 18. So we'll just kind of work through it and then maybe make some other comments about application at the end. So verse 18, "And the subject, his disciples announced op angelon." This is from Op Angelo. We're going to have more announcing going on, I think, to John and for John's sake, if I could say it that way. "His disciples announced to John about all these things." And then we have a participle. John, later in the verse, is the nominative singular masculine referent. Pros kaleomai means to summon. And summoning, or after he had summoned, two certain ones of his disciples, John, verse 19 now, leaking over there, sent, presumably them, to the Lord, saying, and it's punctuated as question mark, just in context, "Are you emphatic So the sue there is a little, you know, it's unnecessary, so there's a little emphasis there. Are you the coming one, or, and now a deliberative subjunctive from prosdokao, which means to look for or expect, or, in a question, translate, shall we look for, or since it's a present subjunctive, shall we go on looking, maybe, for Alan another? Now, there's a little bit of irony here. If you turn back to Luke chapter 3, verse 15, I just did a little word study of how prostakao is used in Luke's gospel. And it's interesting that it, in the ministry of John himself in 3:15, that verse starts with a genitive absolute, as all the people were expecting and dialoguing in their hearts about John, lest he might be the Christ. And so the people are they're expecting, and of course John's answer is, no, I'm not the Christ. I baptize with water, but the Christ is the mightier one. But now, in light of his own experience, John is actually asking a genuine question. You can see in the commentaries and also in the ancient Christian commentary volumes how the some of the church fathers were very reluctant to imagine that John was actually asking a question. I mean, they thought that how could the baptizer have any doubts or questions whatsoever, and they typically point to John chapter 1, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And so sometimes they suggest that, well, John didn't really have a question. He just sent, the question was for the sake of his disciples. That's what they suggest. And I suppose that's possible, but that's not what it says. Right, and we'll see that the question is offered not just once, as it is in Matthew, but twice. So John is, I don't think we have to think of John as losing faith completely or apostatizing or anything that severe, but he is actually asking a question. Are you the coming one, or shall we expect, look for another? And then, because Luke repeats himself, verse 20, paragenomenoi is... has men later in the verse as the referent. Paragenomai means to show up or to appear. And after they had appeared to him, the men said, and note the redundancy, John the baptizer sent us to you, saying, legon, singular participle. See, this is John saying it. Are you the coming one, or shall we look for another? So the question is actually repeated, which, of course, lends some emphasis to it. And it's not too difficult to imagine why, and to find other examples of this in the testimony of Scripture. The one that readily comes to mind is Elijah, where in chapter 18 he's triumphantly killing the prophets of Baal, and in chapter 19 he's on the run, saying, "Lord, kill me, because I'm the only one who's left." So I think, again, it's a genuine question, and it's occasioned by the contrast between what John had hoped for and what seems to be his own experience, I think. So continuing then in Luke 7, verse 21. So now we get kind of the answer to the question and the springboard into the second part of the text. So, en ekene tehura, and that day... He, Jesus, healed many, pelus, from diseases and whippings or torments and evil spirits. And here's a new verb, ekharisata. Charizomai means to freely give, or sometimes can mean forgive. And it's deponent, which is why we have the ta ending. This would just be an aorist indicative deponent. Middle deponent, third singular. He freely gave to many blind people, blepain, to see. Now, I never know what to do with verbal aspect. You know, I'm not as confident as Dr. Vels, and I also don't know as much as Dr. Vels. But I did wonder if you could give this present infinitive and inceptive force, almost as if it were anablepo, to begin to see, to regain their sight. But it's the object of the verb echarisita. So it's interesting how Luke highlights in that very time. So I don't know if we should, if we're to imagine that while, you know, the two disciples come to Jesus and say, "Are you the coming one?" He says, "Well, hold on just a second," and then he goes, "Wham, wham, 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 wham," and heals a bunch of people, you know, and then he turns back. I mean, that's the way the narrative is actually structured. But maybe it's just in that general context. And so after doing these deeds of restoring the creation, and that's what they are, Jesus is not just showing off here. He's restoring human creatures to something more in line with how God designed us to be. Verse 22, "And answering, he," Jesus said, "to them," to the disciples. Here we have just what Daniel Wallace would probably call an attendant circumstance participle. "Go, ap an gelata, announce to John, ha, what you saw and heard." Okay. Now notice the announcing. There was already a report about Jesus that was announced to John in verse 18, right? But that wasn't, it didn't help. It didn't, you know, it didn't assuage John's doubts or fears. So Jesus simply, in a sense, repeats the message. "Look, I'm here. I'm doing these things. I am the coming one." That's the import of it. And then we have a kind of a pastiche, or it's not exactly an Old Testament quotation. If you look at the reference, the reference in the margin there of Nestle Aland, you see Isaiah 29, Isaiah 35, and 42, and so forth. And so it's more like the language of Isaiah, if I could say it that way. So go and announce to John what you saw and heard, and here's what it was. Blind people are receiving sight, a bunch of present indicatives now. Lame people are walking, lepers are being cleansed, and deaf people are hearing. The adjective kophos is a funny word because it means blunt. And you can be blunt with more than one sense. In this case, because the verb is akouo, it means blunt of hearing. But at least one place, I think it might be in Mark, a man is described as blunt of tongue. And so he's mute. So it actually can refer to different crippling or disabilities. So deaf people are hearing, dead people are being raised, poor people are being good newsed, or are, as we might say, having good news preached to them. So this is what's going on. And of course, this picks up the Nazareth sermon in Luke chapter 4, where the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, right? Jesus says, set the captives free, announce good news to the poor, and proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord's favor, and so forth. So he says, "Look at my ministry. Yes, I'm the one." And now comes this somewhat cryptic verse 23. "And whoever," hasean, "is not stumbleized," or caused to stumble, "en emoi," often translated causally, "because of me, is blessed." You could stop the reading there, I think, and that would work, and I think that would communicate the major part of the theology of the text, because although Jesus in truth is the coming one, there are odd things about his ministry, and odd things will happen to those who are attached to it, even to John himself, whom Jesus will about to reveal as someone who's even greater than a prophet, but as someone who actually is prophesied about, right? So, this text is one of many in Scripture, of course, which is sort of death to the Jesus as great Barca lounger theology, you know, where you believe in Jesus and follow him and he'll make you happy. Well, in fact, I think of this sometimes when we sing the Benedictus, you know, "You child shall be called the," how's that go, "servant of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his way, to give his people knowledge of salvation, you know, to guide our feet into the way of peace." It all sounds really good, doesn't it? And John got his head cut off by a two-bit tyrant because he wasn't man enough to stand up against his wife and her daughter. You know, it's really bizarre to our way of thinking. And yet, it's a very hopeful message for those who are struggling, right? Christians struggling with their sins, Christians struggling with difficulty in life, with dreams that have been crushed by circumstances beyond their control. I mean, this is a very hopeful message. Are you the coming one? The answer is, yeah, I'm the coming one. Right? And all the signs of Jesus, which are about the restoring of life, so eyeballs working, right, legs working, skin being clean and people restored to the community life, ears working, life restored, poor receiving good news. You can actually say all of those came to a focus in the moment when Jesus himself was restored, right, to life after taking all of that against himself. And he offers good news. So it's really it's an opportunity, an invitation to walk by faith and not by sight. But we'll keep going because it's the appointed text. And so we start verse 24 with a genitive absolute. Notice this is, we all know, I think, that angelos means messenger, although it's normally translated angels. This may be the only place in the synoptic tradition, in the synoptic gospels, where angelos actually refers to messengers. I don't know of another place. Since it's an aorist participle, ap el thontone, after the angels of John had departed, right? The messengers of John. Now, I like that it's kind of a double movement. So they were messengers from John, but now guess what? They've just become messengers to John, right? So, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, so maybe that's something for us as well. Not only do we receive messengers who offer us this hopeful word, but we actually become messengers to encourage one another. I saw a student today who looked relatively downcast, and I asked if he was still baptized. And he said, yes, I am. And I said, so am I. And so we agreed that we would hold on to that today. So after the messengers of John had departed, he began from Archemai, he began to say to the crowds about John. And now we have this series of questions. Notice the punctuation difference. We've got te ex eothata eis tein erimon, and then a raised semicolon, right? And then theosisthai with a raised semicolon and a number one. That's just telling you that there's different ways to punctuate. And so the difference would be if you follow the first punctuation and pause after desert, then te has to be translated as why, which it readily can be, right? Why did you, plural, go out into the desert? Pause. And the suggested answer, ironic, to see a reed, right? The other way you can do it, and it's just a contextual decision, I don't think it changes much, is to read theosasthai with what precedes, in which case you wouldn't translate to as why, but as what, right? So what did you go out into the desert to see? And just for grins, we'll take it that way. Question. Now, the accusative of the implied repeated verb, to see a reed by wind being saleuod, shaken. Nobody quite knows what to do with this. I tend to think with at least a lot of people that it's sort of a metaphor for a vacillator. You know, a reed shaken by the wind bends this way and that way, you know. So is this what you thought John was? And the answer, of course, is, well, hardly anybody thought that. So the answer is no, that's not why you went out. Verse 25, Allah, rather, what did you go out to see? Note the shift to idain from theosasthai. I don't think it means any difference. I think it's just, you know, synonymity, word, a variation for stylistic purposes. What did you go out to see? A man, and now in soft clothings, plural there, aim fias menon. This is from, I actually had to look it up to make sure, this is from amphienemy. It's not a very common verb, Ben, so you don't have to feel bad about that. And it means to clothe something. And we actually had a form similar to this in Greek Club, Ben, that you asked about yesterday, that eta on the beginning is the duplication of the perfect stem. It's amphienemy. And so the other way, in fact, this will be, I've got two of my Greek stalwarts here, two of our Greek stalwarts here. What would be the other sign that this was actually a perfect participle rather than maybe, say, a present stem participle? Right? There are two signs that come to mind. And I'm asking this because these guys that are sitting with me might actually get this.
Yeah, fourth years.
Yeah, fourth. No, you guys are good. Well, there's no connecting vowel.
Yeah, I was going to say the connecting there's vowel.
And oddly enough, the accent. Yeah, if it were, the accent is on the penult, and yet it's a short ultima. So if this were a present participle, it would go back to the anti-penult. Right? Now, if you know this, and you share this with your board of elders in your first call, I mean, they will be really, really impressed. That's not
salary.
That's yes, yeah. No, that's not true at all. So anyway, what did you go out to see? A man in soft clothing being dressed. Okay, take it as passive. Okay. Answer: you do look. Now this is an interesting phrase. Again, I'm more. It's interesting. I keep trying to backfill with Matthew in my head, but this is Luke. So we've got hoi en hematismo en doxe kai trife hipparchontes. So hipparcho means to be or exist or to live. So those who exist in connection with splendid clothing and luxury. I had to look up trife. It's a noun that means luxury. Are, the verb is at the very end, asin, are in the kingly things. Basileos is an adjective that means kingly or royal and presumably means kingly dwellings or something like that. Matthew has the houses of kings in this parallel. So no, John isn't that kind of a guy either. He doesn't shop at Saks or, you know, Bloomingdale's or something. He's a Walmart kind of guy, if I could say it that way. See? Here in the happiest time of the year. Verse 26, rather, what did you go out to see? Propheten, prophet? Notice that even this is an inadequate answer. So yeah, in a way, yes, I say to you, and here's a comparative adjective followed by the genitive of comparison, one greater or one more abundant than a prophet. Now here's the payoff. This one is concerning whom it stands written. And now we have the famous composite quote. The first line is, strictly speaking, or it could be, from Exodus 23, verse 20. And the second line is from Malachi 3, verse 1. It's probably the case that in both Matthew and Luke, we're supposed to kind of work at least a little bit with both. But the dominant reference, I think, here is to the Malachi passage. So it's the promise of the one who will prepare the way for the Lord before he comes to his temple to judge and to cleanse and to save, ultimately. So, and the Greek is pretty easy. Behold, I am sending my angel, there's angel again, messenger, before your face. Notice how it's become your face. In the Old Testament, it's my face. So, as happens so often, Jesus gets put into the place of Yahweh, right? Who will kata skewadzo prepare the way of you before you? And again, so who is John? He's this figure. He's this angelos, right? And again, there's irony here because John has to send angeloi, right? And then angeloi gets sent back to him. So even the messenger himself needs to receive the message. Oh, maybe this would be a good devotion at a pastoral conference, right? Even the messengers need to receive the message. I say to you, verse 28. Now, this is a little awkward. The subject is udes, and then the verb is estin toward this in the second line there. No one is maidzone then becomes the predicate nominative, and it's the comparative of megas, which means greater. No one is greater among born ones of women, genetois is just an adjective that's functioning as a noun. There's no article on it, but it's functioning as a noun. Among those born of women. Now we have the genitive of comparison, than John. So you have to fix it, you have to say something like, no one is greater than John among those born of women. Something like that. But the literally smaller, mikratros, is a comparative. But in the New Testament, the grammars tell us, comparatives often function as superlatives. And so this is often translated not as smaller, but smallest. Not lesser, but least. There is, interestingly, actually, and you do see it, there is a superlative form that would fit here, and it would be elachistos. That would mean least. But it's normally translated here. The least in the reign of God is greater than he. And this verse, of course, most of these verses are fairly strongly discussed and debated. Sometimes people want to suggest, and I think this goes back centuries, this view, that the referent here in this last clause is to Jesus himself, that he's the least in the reign of God. But that strikes me as unlikely and as somehow not fitting as nicely into the context. Certainly there'd be nothing you could understand that in a good way doctrinally. But I think Jesus is actually just saying to the people listening to him that as amazingly important in the history of salvation as John is, what's happening now in me is so great that if you belong to that, then in some sense you're greater than John. And so it's kind of a historical point, if I can say it that way. It's not meant to denigrate John at all, but I think it's meant to uplift for Jesus' hearers the significance of what Jesus himself is doing and what John himself announced. And that actually is kind of reinforced if you just took the next two verses, which are part of the parenthetical suggestion for the lectionary. All the crowd, when they heard, and the tax collectors, they declared God in the right. They justified God. They said, oh yeah, God is doing, right? These are God's ways, because they had been baptized with the baptism, we'd have to translate, with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and the law experts set aside the will of God unto themselves because they had not been baptized by him. So again, the people and the tax gatherers here, who at this point at least are following Jesus, and at least some of them believing in him, are rejoicing at this proclamation where the smallest one who has been attached and claimed for the reign of God in Jesus is greater than John the Baptizer. So, which of course brings up all of our cultural standards of greatness and significance and importance. Oh, this is the gospel where God is the one who has cast down the mighty from their thrones and exalted them of low degree. And, you know, this is, in a sense, it's a law application, but it flows out of the gospel. What would it look like? Well, it would look different if in the congregation, in my congregation, you know, I consistently believed this and acted as if God's standards of greatness and promise, the keeping of his promises, were the ones that counted, as opposed to the people who are the most talented or the wealthiest or the most gifted or energetic or whatever. I mean, it would have to do with people in nursing homes, probably, or, you know, people that have been crushed by divorce or great tragedy. I mean, something like that. So, but that just means we have stuff to learn, right? But again, I think the dominant message of this text is you can believe even when you're experienced fights against it, because Jesus has actually come to do what he's doing. And as we heard actually in a very nice way in our chapel homily from Dr. Bierman this morning, our days are not the days of Jeremiah. That was really a great. And he said, yes, there is the not yet to come, but the now, right? The now has actually occurred, and we rejoice in that. So that's enough, I guess, for Advent 3. And again, apologies for no Old Testament reading. But again, we decided that that was my fault. So, all right.
Ben, I was thinking about you specifically.
Yeah.
How do you feel about tutoring Hebrew?
I can do it.